de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us. Just so you're all in the right place or the place you intended to be, this is a session called How Will We Remember This? A workshop on movement, memory, and storytelling with us, who are the editors of Even the River Starts Small, a collection of stories from the movement to stop Line 3. If you are not in the right place, that is okay. And if you want to leave, you are welcome to leave at any time. But we're thrilled that you're here. You all have little cards on your seats that have different questions on them. So you can take a look. They're double-sided. Feel free to read and reflect on those as we present, and hold on to your thoughts for some discussion time later. And they're all different, or there's five different ones, so you can pass them to each other. And we also have a few copies of the book floating around. Some of you already got to take a look at them, but yeah, feel free to keep them moving. It's not rude if you're looking at it while we're talking. And if you're like looking for a little bit more, we're gonna give you some context and some history, but if you're looking for more of that, there is like a section at the very beginning of the book that has a timeline with some more concrete information. Cool. Great. And if any of us are not talking loud enough or like not meeting your needs, feel free to just be like, I'm talking too fast. Okay, great. That is probably feedback we will all need to hear a few times. So thank you. So you're going to hear more about the specifics of the project in just a few minutes from some of our team members, but the project was a grassroots endeavor to create a book of personal stories from the movement to stop the Line 3 pipeline. And that pipeline, the Line 3 pipeline, is a tar sands oil pipeline that all of us, along with many other people, a couple who are in this room, tried really hard to stop, led by Anishinaabe people in so-called Minnesota. And after the pipeline was completed, we decided that we wanted to make this book as a way to remember and learn from the really wide variety of experiences that people had while involved in the fight. So we're gonna just introduce all of ourselves now. So I'll start, because I'm here. I'm Jenna, I use she, her pronouns. I live in Minneapolis, you can hear that one a few times. And I moved to the cities in 2018 and got involved with the fight to stop Line 3 pretty quickly thereafter. I played a lot of roles over my years involved in the fight from like 2018 to 2021, including mostly including legal support, coordination, and action planning, and then, of course, making this book. And I'm currently a librarian who is excited to be transitioning out of her Line 3 projects 3 years later and starting some new work up in the cities. I'm gonna pass it this way.
Hello. My name is Abby. I'm here because this project is very dear to my heart. The movement to stop Line 3 changed my life insofar as it took the idea of climate organizing from something that was kind of like felt very far away, very theoretical. I didn't know what it actually looked like. And then it brought me all these skills and brought them into practice. And it was a very beautiful moment of transformation that I saw in myself and many people that I'm close to. And that like brought me onto a journey that has taken me, now I live in Minneapolis and I'm a labor organizer, and I'm very excited to be here today with all of you.
Hi, I'm a teller. I'm like a kind of born and and like and a kind of raised in like in a kind of a Minnesota. I kind of jumped into the fight on the kind of a tail end and kind of jumped in as a kind of a construction, like a kind of a started, taking on like a kind of actions, and then ended up being a sort of like chaplain-ish kind of a person. Oh, cool. Like, thank you. And on that vein of things, it is, like a kind of a, this a fight and these kinds of experiences, like that of a kind of a caused, like a kind of a caused me, to, like a, to a think about a seminary, and going on to be a pastor and a chaplain. But as of now, I am a staffer at a workers' center in a kind of a Minneapolis. So.
Hi, everyone. First things first, it's wonderful to see you all here. We spent a lot of time whispering to each other saying, do you think anyone's going to come? And my goodness, you came, and what a thrill and what an honor it is. My name's Ellie. I was part of the movement to stop Line 3 from 2020 into 2021, so that was like the end stages of the permitting process into all of active construction. I was a student during that time. I was a junior and a senior in college, and I feel like that really heavily shaped my experience of it. I was doing a lot of student mobilizing to the front lines and a lot of like campus actions, stuff like that. And in addition to like being in a student sphere, I feel like just the fact of being 20 years old in a movement like this was really formative for the movement and for the rest of my life. And I think the stories of young people are really present in this book in a way that I think is salient and maybe quite different from some other works that you might have read.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dio. I use they, them pronouns. I grew up on the East Coast and moved to Minnesota for college. Was never intending to stay there, but got involved in pipeline fighting, and very quickly it like became most of my life and the thing that I was thinking about and stressing out about when I woke up at 3 a.m. for a period of years. Met all of these beautiful people, incredible organizers, as well as so many others, and really built just incredible like communities of resistance in a way that now has like rooted me in a place that I never intended to stay. Like the rest of my family is really thousands of miles or 8,000 miles away. I mostly, my organizing in the during the Line 3 movement was a lot around media work and the creation of art and arts organizing, which is all stuff that I still do now, but on sort of different scales of urgency. Like I, since the Line 3 movement, I haven't been involved in such a campaign that is like truly everything that I was thinking about nonstop for over a year.
Good morning, everyone. Yeah, thanks again for being here. My name is Hayes. I also live in South Minneapolis. When Haymarket ended up publishing this book, which you'll hear, we had to submit all of our addresses for the contract, and we live in like a 20 square block radius of each other. So we're all Minneapolis kids these days. Yeah, I got involved in fighting Line 3 when I first moved to Minnesota in 2017. And I was politicized through the pipeline fight. So it was my first political home and the space for my political development. And I'm so grateful for those experiences to have been politicized into radical left thought, especially under teachings of indigenous land stewardship and land defense, is a perspective that I like carry into the movement that is what grounds me. And I've continued to organize in the energy sector, as well as other projects and campaigns, but I'm most concerned about, questions of energy systems. You know, I came into the pipeline fight really concerned about like carbon emissions, climate change, and left the movement interested in revolution and radical land back and dismantling an energy and extractive economy that is killing the planet, not just with carbon emissions, but you know, the extraction of new frontiers of extractivism, of minerals and other things
are weighing on my heart these days as we face new frontiers of extractivism on Anishinaabe Aking and across Turtle Island. So that's a little bit about us. Jenna, take us away.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Thanks everyone for sharing a little bit more about yourself. And now we're gonna speak for a little bit. Sorry, my mask is really stuck on my earring. We're gonna share a little bit more about the history of the movement and the pipeline itself. So I'm gonna pass it over to you.
Hey, the question is, how and why did we create this book? To start off, we want to state that the Line 3 pipeline was built on traditional Dakota and Anishinaabe land. That's also where our resistance took place, the movement to stop Line 3. It's where our team met and formed. Some of us grew up in Minnesota, and we have family lineages of settler colonialism there. Others of us have come more recently. Each of us, however, found that engaging in this work encouraged us to think about our relationship to the land and its original stewards and how we can create intentional relationships moving forward. And so now, what even is the Line 3 pipeline?
Cool. So I'll try to keep this brief-ish. a kind of a tar sands field in Alberta, and then a kind of a going through northern, like a kind of a Minnesota, and then onto a kind of a Wisconsin, at the Superior terminal, and all of this is owned by Enbridge, a corporation, who is also a kind of a famous building a dapple on top of this. And all of this, kind of a watershed.
So the movement itself was pretty multifaceted. It looked a lot of different ways. From the time that the project was proposed in 2014 until the time that construction was completed in 2021, people resisted in multiple ways. To quote one of the submissions from the anthology, "We fought Line 3 through the permitting process and the construction process. We fought with petitions, rallies, marches, banners, graffiti, lockdowns, blockades, camps. We fought in the courtrooms, at the banks, on the construction sites, but Enbridge built the damn pipeline anyway." And this is
And kind of this is the kind of a place where a kind of a many of us on our team and a kind of a people in the book like a kind of a spent a like a kind of a pretty big a chunk of our time like a kind of at these camps. And a kind of life at the camp is like a kind of also a kind of a like a kind of a like a kind of a large like kind of a part of our book like a kind of a talking about like a kind of a cooking like in a kind of a weathering like a kind of a storms in our like in our kind of old and like in a kind of a dingy a tents and a talks by the fire. And so, yeah, you can like a kind of like a find all of like a these like a kind of like a stories in our book. So,
Kind of like Trey was saying, the stories of the resistance in the book skew towards the later end of the resistance, so it is really heavy on that period. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Sort of like what Ellie was saying, I was a student at the time that I got involved in the movement. My major was environmental studies, and I thought that that would teach me everything I needed to know about climate change and how to save the world. And I was very wrong about that. I still wouldn't say I'm anywhere near close knowing what to do about it. In September 2019, I attended my first ever Line 3 event. It was called the Gichigami Gathering. It took place on the shores of Gichigami, also known as Lake Superior. And I remember sitting there for about 2 hours when one speaker after another spoke incredibly clearly and incredibly well about how widely and deeply felt the issue of Line 3 was. And it was all these people who were, closer to the actual pipeline route itself. They were living there. They were going to watch the earth get torn up. And they wanted us to do something about it. So if you compare that to what I was learning in school, what I was learning in college at the time, I was a senior. And I remember having these talks where they were like, you guys need to start thinking about your careers and how you're going to be a productive member of society. And so they would bring in, someone who worked for the DNR. And I would sit there and listen to them talk about how much they love their job because it helped them protect the trees. Cut to a few months later, I would watch some members of the DNR arrest my friends for trying to save the trees from being cut down for the pipeline. My school also brought someone from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency by to tell us how wonderful it was that they got to protect the water in the course of their job. And that turned out to be a really huge lie too. Just a few weeks after that happened, all my friends and I were devastated when we saw that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency issued the final permits necessary to begin construction of the pipeline. And so after that point, because I had been introduced to all these wonderful people who were trying to teach me the ways that we were going to resist this pipeline together, I ended up, dropping everything and moving up north and living in resistance camps for weeks at a time. Suddenly all of my schoolwork, I was making it about Line 3, and I couldn't drop the issue. And it turned into this really beautiful living resistance. It was during the pandemic, and so we had been so isolated from other people, but suddenly, even though we were masked and separated from each other out of precaution, I still got to march with people along the way and witness this really beautiful form of resistance. This resistance also came on the heels of the George Floyd uprisings, which happened all over the country, but especially in Minneapolis. And so as we were resisting, which oftentimes took the form of locking down to construction equipment or marching in the road, we were met with this incredibly, fierce response from local police agencies. They created this entity called the Northern Lights Task Force, which was like essentially a coalition of different cops in the area that would spread information about how to deal with us. We watched them get new equipment, new clothes to wear, things like that. And they were in fact being paid to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars by Enbridge. Not only was it like local police, county police, it was also the DNR officers and state troopers. And I remember one of our very final large-scale mobilizations took place on the lawn of the state capitol in Minnesota just a few weeks before the oil pipeline was going to go online and the oil was going to start flowing. There was a beautiful sort of encampment on the lawn, and they put up about 20 teepees, and you know, hundreds of people came to witness this smaller scale occupation, I guess maybe you'd call it. And the state troopers were there the whole time. They were there in force. There was, you know, dozens of them just watching us the whole time. And as the days ticked by, they sort of like, you know, pushed themselves in, and you know, the teepees started to come down, and it felt like this incredibly tragic moment. And I remember turning to some of the people that I'm standing up with here today, and this question coming to us of like, how will we remember this? We have to remember how strongly all these people stood up. And so the answer was maybe creating a book.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking to just like listen back and reflect. Thank you for the reflections, Abby. And I would encourage everybody to like take the time and read some of the stories in the collection. You know, hundreds of people shared their stories with us in the process of making this book, and we want those stories to be remembered. So I just am like feeling that heaviness as we start. But Dio and I are going to talk a little bit about the process of actually making this project and how we created the book. And, you know, as you've seen, the questions on your chairs, can people hear me all right? So, you know, some of what we want to talk about today is both the practical dimensions of this book and the process, but also some of the questions that we grappled with as a team around how do we commemorate, what stories to include, whose voices matter, these questions that feel really important, I hope, to many of our movement contexts. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the process and some of the decisions we made grappling with the questions that we're going to then discuss a little bit later in groups. So I guess I'll tell the origin story. And I think, like Abby said, for each of us, it was a different, you know, sort of moment. One moment that stands out when I tell people about this project. So, you know, after they finished building the pipeline, we were all traumatized and exhausted and like finding housing because most people had been living on the front lines. We were spending the months of that winter after construction was done hashing and rehashing these stories, like gathering together and talking about, do you remember that day? Or even like there were people that I had like been ships in the night. We hadn't crossed paths. Like I'd see them, you know, we'd like run into each other jumping in the river, but they were driving 100 miles that way and I had to go jail watch this way. So there was all this like recounting, you know, what had happened and what was your experience. And so it was getting a little tired. Like we were really, this was the only thing we could talk about. And so some friends of ours resolved, like, you know, we're all in our 20s, like we're gonna throw a house party and we're gonna be cool and normal. We're gonna meet other people. We're not gonna talk about the pipeline. It's time. This was like whatever, January or February that year after the construction was done. So they threw a punk show in their basement, you know, as you do in Minneapolis. And halfway through the night, maybe, I'm standing in the kitchen talking to someone about line 3. The music is downstairs. Like, there's clearly a party happening down there, so all the people we don't know must be down there because every group in the kitchen is somebody that I know from the pipeline fight standing around talking to other kids from the movement, trading war stories, and, like, talking about the movement. And, you know, this was, like, 5 months out. Now here we are 3.5 years out, and we are still telling these stories. I would say it's less, but sometimes we still find ourselves being like, oh shit, guys, that's dinner wrapped, and we only talked about line 3, right? So the point being, we had the strong sense that people wanted an outlet and a place to share their stories. And Dio and I had worked really closely together in the movement, doing media work, doing story work, and telling a really specific kind of story, right? Like the simple story, you guys know in movement, like you have to tell people the basics. Like it's gonna poison your water. This is the worst, most evil climate catastrophe of our lifetimes. We must stop it. Like, and that was an important story, but it didn't hold the nuance and all the complexity of the thousands of people's like lived experience of what it meant to participate in a movement like this, right? Those stories were not something that we could represent when we were sending out press releases that had the same freaking quote four times, like, don't build the pipeline, please, right? And so we knew, or we expected that there was a desire for people to share those more granular, day-to-day, personal, contradictory stories, and we asked for people to submit them, and they did.
Do you, right?
Yeah. And they did in mass, which was pretty awesome. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the visions that we had for this book. One of the things that we knew pretty early on was that we wanted it to be a book. And I think that speaks a little bit to some of the things that we knew to be true, even from the beginning of the project. We wanted this to be something that would last. We wanted people to like have these memories, especially since the memories that we were talking about were like some of those like day-to-day ones that weren't getting recorded in other places. We wanted that to be able to be put on a shelf and like looked at in 5 years or like looked at frequently. Like it's sort of up to the user to choose how to engage with it, but we knew that that was the container for it. And the other interesting thing about a book is it has a print date, and after that there are not changes to be made for it. And we were not interested in creating some sort of like collection of media that could constantly be updated as things move on. And we were going to take this energy of this movement and we were going to sort of try to memorialize this section of it in a print thing. And one of the things that I was just remembering as I was thinking about like what it means to actually have a book, so much of the media work that we did in the movement was things like Hayes was saying, news articles and things that sort of exist outside of many lived experiences. And then there was everyone's like, you know, personal like archival materials and everyone's phone storage and whatnot. And a lot of the rest of that sort of like liminal space stuff was on like Facebook accounts of groups who were filming direct actions, and like things were living in places that then like now no longer exist. Like if a page on Facebook gets deleted, like, oh, there goes like a, like 5 years of movement memory. And like we were not archiving those. I'm sure somebody at Facebook has those, but like we don't have access to those. And so there was a real desire in the creation of this to like have a space to like hold on to some of these things. One of the other big, really important things that we knew we were looking for in the creation of this book was we wanted something that felt like the movement. And in, you know, even just hearing us speak now, like obviously this is something that all of us, you know, care passionately about, has shaped all of our lives, politicized all of us in various ways, and, you know, was the only thing that people were talking about at house parties. And it was a really, like, it was a really beautiful time in a lot of our lives, and it was really politically important. And it was also like fucking terrible. Like I was looking at my camera roll this morning of photos of 2021, like trying to put myself in the mind space of like when we started asking for these stories. And there's a lot of photos of me like crying in my car and like having a meltdown. And then next to photos of like these beautiful experiences with these incredible friends that I was making who were changing my life in so many ways. And like, that's what it felt like to live in this movement. It was just like one, like whiplash, one thing after another, like beautiful experiences and hard experiences and incredible like political realizations and really silly and beautiful and like sweet moments. And all of those were together. And so one of the big decisions that we made about this book was that we were not interested in writing a history of the movement. We were not interested in doing anything chronologically. We wanted the process of flipping through the book, like some of you got the chance to do, and I would encourage you to continue doing as we're talking. Things hop around, like we hop around between different perspectives, we hop around between different like types of involvement in the movement, different like emotions that these stories have. And that more than anything else is like what it felt like to be living in those moments. And now that we're a few years out looking back and flipping through the book, like I'm so glad we did that, because it really does like bring you back to some of those emotions of having everything mixed together. One of the stories that we landed on when talking about like some of these early days was an afternoon into evening, I suppose, when the three of us sat on the floor of my house for a number of hours nonstop with big sheets of paper trying to map out all of the characters that we new in the movement. And all of the different groups of people that were doing different types of work, all of the different things that we had heard about happening before any of us got involved, that we needed to reach out to people that we wanted to make sure knew about this project so that when we had a final thing, it represented the diversity of experience to the best of our abilities of like this movement that lasted a decade. And so, you know, we mapped out the lawyers and the people leading direct action and the people leading legal cases for years prior and friends doing jail support and like all of those things and trying to really make sure that we did a good enough job of like, you know, at least offering to people the opportunity to participate in this project. And so highlighted in this book is not only like a diversity of tactics and a diversity of like personal experience, but also a lot of contradictions. Like some people, you know, came to this movement for a few months and left and don't want to speak about it again and are not interested. And some people, you know, are still talking about it this many years later. And we hope that that would come through in the book to like highlight those contradictions of complicated movement spaces that often is not what you get when you read stories of like history of movements. Like, you know, maybe they talk about those, but it doesn't, you don't get to really live in those contradictions as much as you do in a book like this when you're reading people's firsthand accounts of like their experience in conjunction with like everybody else's. In terms of like some of the other, I would say that those are the visions that we had for the book. And then some of the like really concrete decisions that we made, you know, it being a book, was, you know, the first and maybe most important one. But we also decided pretty early on that like we were not the people to be collecting and we were not interested in creating a collection of like tactical analysis or political analysis of what the movement was, that we were interested in creating a container for stories. And that was something that, you know, we had to stress a lot because a lot of people, us included, have a lot of like political and tactical analysis of this. We would all love to talk to you about it at any point. Just come find us. We can talk about it for hours. But that we were not the people to be creating this, and we didn't, I think that would have been an entirely different project. But we were going after like a storytelling and like those day-to-day things that were making up this movement. And one of the other ways that we achieved that, another decision that we made, is that everything in this book is published anonymously, which is not something that you often find in archives and in history. Usually that's, you know, not an intentional choice from the beginning. That's something that gets lost throughout history. But in encouraging people to submit something to this project, to like trust us with their words and their stories, not knowing what the final product would be like, I think the decision to publish all of these things anonymously allowed people to feel like they did have a story to tell. And as Hayes was saying, like there's always these, you know, stories that are told sort of within the movement and also about the movement that are like the narrative points that you're supposed to hit when you're trying to convince people why this matters. But the downside of that is that oftentimes individuals don't feel like they can or should have anything to say, especially when it comes to those things like contradictions and like bad experiences or like really good experiences in really hard times. And so in encouraging people to both submit things anonymously and also the promise that we would publish them anonymously, I think we got a lot of like really like raw and important stories that otherwise like wouldn't have a place to be shared. And that, I think, is one of the decisions that, like, yeah, shaped this project in ways that I think set it aside from, like, some of these other history books that we're reading. And it is one of the questions that we hope we'll all get to discuss later, like, the role of, like, anonymity and how that plays into archives and, you know, what gets lost in that, too. Like, it's not, you know, a silver bullet for everything. And then the last thing that I want to talk about in terms of decisions for this book was we decided to do it really quickly. And maybe that was because it was all we could think about and talk about, and we had sort of finished doing direct actions on the pipeline and we didn't know what else to do, and oil was about to start flowing, but what were we supposed to just like go back to our lives and like find rentals in Minneapolis and I don't know, work for the DNR? So we jumped into this project really quickly. Like Abby was saying, we sort of started asking these questions to our friends and to people we were in movement spaces with as, you know, direct actions were finishing up, as they were finishing the pipeline. Our first public call for stories in this collection was around the time that oil started flowing through the pipeline. And I mean, that was another thing that like really shaped the book, because some people like were really ready to give us those moments that happened just a couple of weeks or months ago, like those things that really stuck in people's memories that maybe would have been lost like 5 years down the line. And other people were not ready to think about this and were not ready to like write anything down and had no interest in submitting to this project. And we ended up extending our deadline a lot. This project grew to bigger than we expected it to be, and we took a long time in like getting all of the things that would later turn into this book. But we really did start early. And so one of the other questions that we'll hopefully talk about later, and one of the questions that we've asked you is like, you know, when is the right time to commemorate something? And like how does timing impact the way that we memorialize things? And so this project specifically was like a really quick timeline from when the movement was still happening to we also started doing this archival process as we were going on. And of course the downside of that is that like we missed something. Some people were not interested in participating in the project because it didn't feel emotionally ready, and because some parts of the movement were still going on, like some of those things are not captured in this book.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think one of the interesting things that bears just mentioning, like, you know, some of you maybe know more and less about Line 3, there were over 1,000 arrests on the pipeline corridor during direct action and prayerful protest. And the court proceedings and the trial process was like a long ongoing thing that continued even after we published this book. There are a couple of cases still in litigation even with defendants. So the book has a lot of writing about jail support and arrests, but not as much writing about the court process and the legal proceedings. And so like thinking about these questions of temporality, right? Like we couldn't capture that stuff because it wasn't done yet by the time that we were finishing the book. So just questions about like when is the right moment.
The other thing I forgot to say about that is like there are stories in this book from about 10 years of resistance, but another gap is like those early years when none of us were involved, there was still lots of resistance and so many of those like daily life stories. And, you know, we got stories from some people, but, you know, that's not what this book was. This is a product of like the end of construction mostly.
Definitely. A couple more things that we'll talk about in the process of the book. In the early stages, like we've talked about, we received a lot of excitement and eagerness from people to tell their stories. But as you can expect, we also faced like challenges and really critical questions of the project. As you all know, like it's hard to collaborate and it's hard to be in movement and it's hard to hold responsibilities to contradictory movements. And so this project, like any project, we faced real challenges. Part of it was about the timing. Part of it was about whether we as the group of people were the right people to carry forward a project like this, right? No one on our team is indigenous to Minnesota. Our team was mostly white. And we faced questions around whether we were the right people, whether it was the right time, whether we were taking up space in the movement. And we paused the project and we grappled really seriously with people that were bringing those criticisms to us, with relationships that we had. And we started talking to people across the movement, you know, our mentors, people we had worked with over the years. And we got some really good advice from a collaborator that Dio and I and others worked with, who's an artist and graphic designer, Anishnabig from White Earth, who advised us to consult with our elders, right? Like to ask our teachers and movement leadership, the people who had mentored us in the movement, who'd been resisting on this land for a long time, whose ancestors had been resisting on this land for a long time, to ask our elders, you know, whether to talk through some of the questions. And in those conversations, in talking with people, especially in older movement generations, with leadership we had relationships with, people were really emphatically supportive that if we wanted to do this project, if we had the energy and the time to spend 1,000 volunteer hours compiling these stories, and that we were committed to like doing it collaboratively, to inviting everyone that we could, to do it with the best like integrity and within our relationships that we held, that we had built over years of the movement, they advised us to do that, you know, and to be courteous and to be humble, but to continue. And so we decided to proceed with the project, despite having some challenging conversations in those early kind of formation moments of the project, which was just, it was a tremendous like learning opportunity, I think, for all of us. Is that what I want to say? Am I missing anything?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit that and a little bit like yes, like, go for it. Like, stop, you know, you don't actually have to ask us permission. Like, they were like, obviously, like, if you care about this, you should do it. Like, I think the way that Hayes described it, like, made it sound a little bit more serious than it was, even though these conversations were serious and important. But they were like, yeah, obviously, like, keep going, which was really, like, nice and reassuring to hear.
Yeah, and it was so funny, you know, like, especially getting advice from elders is fantastic and so humbling. We had a couple of conversations with an elder in Minnesota, great-grandmother Mary Lyons, who's a published author some of you maybe encountered. And so the three of us went to a call with her, and we're, like, nervous, we're prepping, we have all these questions. And she's like, why isn't it already done? Like, I want to read your stories. You guys have work to do, you have stories to tell, like, get it done. And the three of us were like, yeah, aye, captain, like, say less, we are on it, you know? And so from that point kind of continued and proceeded forward. And we took a lot of feedback that we got from people in our community. We expanded our team. We kind of deepened some democratic processes for how we carried forward the book. And I think being challenged in that early period of the book really helped us deepen our kind of integrity and principles of how we moved through it, which I was really grateful for. So just a little bit about building the book. I think every single page of the book reflects like hundreds of decisions that we spent hours discussing. If you're interested in like CMYK color profiles for the color orange, or our like copy editing and where we put semicolons and where we didn't, like find us later. We decided we weren't going to give that talk, even though I know there's some book people in the room, so like, you know, find us with those questions. But a few things about the book that feel cool, like the process of actually compiling the stories. Jenna texted the two of us one time during the pipeline fight that she was going to go up to White Earth for a meeting, because sometimes in this movement you just have to drive 6 hours to figure out what's going on. If you've been involved in land defense, you know what that feeling is, right? And so we created a process for gathering stories that tried to reflect that movement principle. We drove up north on a few occasions to gather stories and do interviews. I took like phone calls where I recorded a matriarch like telling me stories while she was driving to ceremony, and then transcribed it and then sent it back for her to review. We offered people to do interviews where they would share a story. Our writer would draft something narrative and then workshop it with them. We allowed people to submit writing, photos, visual art, collage, any sort of medium that they had to express themselves and their experiences. We tried to have it be multimedia and to make it accessible, because, you know, most people don't want to write, like, ever. And so we tried to really invite people to share stories in ways that felt authentic and possible to them. And as Dio mentioned, you know, our initial timeline was like, we were going to start this book in November and then publish it by September of 2022, yeah. So that didn't happen. We extended the deadlines, and we extended the deadlines, and we called people, and we went back to mapping. Once we started to have the stories, we looked again, like, are we hitting on every experience in the movement? Do we have legal workers? Do we have medics? Do we have cooks? Do we have artists? Do we have children? Do we have elders? Do we have parents of people who got arrested? Like, do we have the experiences? And then calling people again and saying, is there someone you know, or would you like to share a story with us? And if the answer is no, like, why? Is there something that we can do to help you feel comfortable as part of this project, right? So, like, you know, thousands of conversations. In the end, we got over 800 submissions of writing and visual art to the project. And I think our biggest feeling was just, like, abundant gratitude and, like, really, like, just feeling so humbled. People submitted such beautiful stories that changed my perception of this movement that I had been involved with for years at that point. And we were just really honored to be able to hold those stories, and did our best, again, in the editing for hours, to hold the integrity of the stories that had been shared with us. And the last thing I'll just talk about quickly was the editorial process. Oh, we're good on time. Was the editorial process. We created this like democratic collaborative process for reading every submission and using the criteria that we had sort of developed over time to read and discuss and to figure out what we were going to include and what sections of things we would include, making sure that it, you know, would appease our lawyers and that it was safe and that it was values aligned and that it wasn't strategy, but it was personal stories, you know, all those different considerations. It was a really cool democratic and collaborative process, I would say. Yeah, so that's about building the book.
And the final piece that I'm going to talk about before Ellie shares more about the process of distributing the book that Hayes sort of got into a little bit is just like the details of this. All of us are not book publishers until this project. Like, none of us had done this before. There was a lot of learning as we were going in terms of just every step is that's needed to make a book, which was really valuable and really hard. And we collaborated on nearly every single thing in this book, which was just a lot of like hours and a lot of discussion and a lot of debate and a lot of arguing and a lot of like creating beautiful things together. And I think the project production in and of itself was like a really good exercise in a lot of the skills that we had learned in like being involved in these movements and like what it looks like and feels like to like actually be deep in the trouble of a collaborative project with other people. And so the story that I want to tell about like one of the details of this book is, you know, I think it was the weekend before we were set to finally send the book to print. And we had decided that we didn't have a map of the pipeline, but in the spirit of the book, we were not interested in having a super realistic map with lots of text about the pipeline. And we decided to start the book. We were going to draw the Line 3 route and where it intersects with the Mississippi River watershed. So as Hayes just showed, it's on the very front page, you know, shared around with each other. Just to show, like, to start off in the, like, grounding of, like, what it looks like to have something so straight and dark cut through something that's so natural and wild. And, you know, we're pulling information from a bunch of maps. We're marking out some spots that we know along the Mississippi headwaters area that, you know, resistance happened. And a question came up of, like, one particular river, the Shell River, and should it be on this map? Because we couldn't quite figure out if it was part of the Mississippi River watershed. And, you know, we're supposed to be sending these files to print tomorrow. Like, everything else is ready for this. Yeah, there was a resistance camp on the Shell River. There was a lot of stories in the book about that, so we didn't want to leave it out because it was important, but we weren't sure. Like, this is not all the bodies of water. This is the Mississippi River. And so we weren't quite sure if this one river was a tributary of the Mississippi or something else. And we argued about this a lot, and we, like, you know, I called my friend who was working at GIS, and I was like, can you download these, like, state files from me? Like, I need to see if, like, this is categorized here. Hayes was able to, like, get us in touch with a hydrogeologist who was doing movement work. We, like, had a couple of calls with them, and eventually we decided that, or we learned that the Shell River is technically a tributary of the Crow Wing River, which is a tributary of the Mississippi, but there was sort of that step in between. So, like, technically by our criteria, it didn't really work. And everyone else, of course, is like, let's publish the book. Like, we're ready to send print. And we're like, no, we actually have to figure out, like, what this is doing. So we decide to include sort of a part of it to, like, pay homage to it, but to not be lying on our maps, even though all maps are a lie. And so all of that information, all of that arguing and, like, that hours of research is distilled into about, like, a quarter of an inch line, like this little baby line right there. And so that's the story that I give to just illustrate, like, how many things, like, we really thought about from as many different ways as possible in the creation of this book. And a beautiful thing to note is at the end of the book we have that same map without the pipeline as a way to nod towards the future that we're all fighting for. Yeah, wait, okay, the very last thing that I want to say about the process of the book that I remembered and I wrote down this morning was to just, like, end on this note of gratitude and pride that sometimes we lose when, you know, getting really excited about the details of the book, but that so many people were interested in this project and took the time and the emotional effort to write down these experiences, some of which are, like, the hardest experiences of people's lives, and to trust us with all of that work, not knowing what the result would be, is, like, an honor that, you know, Hayes said, like, we don't take lightly, and really allows us to feel like every time this book reaches new hands, like, it is coming truly from all of the people that lived in this movement that took the time and the emotional energy to submit their stories to us, and then, of course, to all of the thousands of hours that, you know, were put into all of these decisions. And it just, like, truly is the most collaborative thing that I personally have ever worked on, and I think, like, is a really beautiful example of, like, what grassroots archive processes, like, can be like. And so just wanted to end the book process section with, like, that amount of gratitude.
And after approximately one bajillion decisions made, the book came out into your hands in May of 2023. Thank you. We self-published our first run of 2,000 books, which, if you're looking at a 300-page full-color book and you know publishing, you know that was very expensive. And we fundraised for it. We wrote a couple of grants earlier in the process to be able to do that, to be able to cover the first run of printing entirely, because we really, really wanted to be able to give it away as a gift to everybody who participated in the movement, whose experiences and stories and contributions to the movement really made this book possible, made it happen. We were actually in talks with a publisher earlier in the process about the possibility of doing a first run through them, and ultimately decided against it because we were so dead set on that idea of giving it as a gift to the people in the movement first before launching it to the wider world of the world of movement, you know, these capital M, lowercase m movement. and give it away as a gift, we certainly did. You know, we wanted to make sure that we sort of cleared it with the people whose stories were included in this book before it hit the rest of the world, you know. And, you know, if they had said, this isn't us at all, we hate it, that would have been that. We wouldn't be here today. But luckily for us and for them, I think we did it decently justice and have been able to continue to distribute it. And in that first year or so of distribution, it was like literally us driving the books all over the state of Minnesota, hand delivering them to people all over, holding events in four different towns, making sure that everybody and their mother who wanted a book had one for free as much as possible. We collected donations for those who were able to contribute to that. But yeah, we all had boxes of books knocking around in our trunks for the better part of a year. And I'll just say that the experience of watching people, many of whom we shared this experience with, discover this book, see themselves in it, you know, watching people flip through it and say, oh my gosh, remember when that happened? Or like, whoa, I forgot about that. You know, just being present for those moments was truly incredible and super rewarding after sitting with this for so long. Because even in that short amount of time, even that year and a half that people had in distance from being so immersed in this world, you know, people's memories had shifted and settled into more permanent states of whatever strongest memories were going to stick with them. And so I think being confronted with those memories after some time away, or sometimes reading someone else's memories of a situation that you experienced was really powerful in ways that really inspired a whole range of reactions from nostalgia to shuddering horror to just the light of a new perspective on something that you thought you knew well. And so now in its second year of public life, it certainly continues to be a reminder for those people whose memories are included in it, but it also, along with the rest of the canon of media that's from and about the time, becomes part of what will represent the movement to stop Line 3 into the future in the minds for everybody who wasn't there, which is the majority of people. And so we realize that we can't hold on to this forever as our stories, even though they might literally be our stories. They're now that you have them, they're your stories too, and they will shape your idea of what happened. And in the vein of not holding on to it forever, I mean that figuratively and also literally, of like our closets in our apartments in South Minneapolis were overrun with books and we needed them out of there eventually. Even The River Starts Small became part of the Haymarket catalog this past winter. And so, yes, shout out to Haymarket. Thank you so much. They've been truly a dream to work with, and we're so excited to have been invited to speak at this conference. So yeah, now it's time for the book to reach all of the people that we personally literally couldn't through Haymarket's website, through local bookstores that have ordered the books, through movement hubs, community centers. I'll say if you run any of those things, if you have like a movement hub with a bookshelf, with a library, pick it up. We really want this book to reach those particular channels. We want it to just spread to people who are doing similar kinds of work wherever they're doing it across the world.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.